Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Make or Break European Summit now underway in Brussels and speak with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. With the German Chancellor saying the Euro has lost credibility and the French leader warning there is no turning back, we'll try to find out if their apocalyptic words will be met with credible deeds and a global economic crisis will be avoided in the next 24 hours as the deadline to come up with a plan to shore up the Euro looms. Then we will look into the apparent loss of a top-secret US spy drone over Iran that appears to have been captured largely intact by the Iranians, who claim their army's electronic warfare unit hacked into the stealth RQ-170 Sentinel's controls and landed it 140 miles inside their territory. An expert on defense, space, and intelligence policy, John Pike, the director of globalsecurity.org, joins us to try to assess the damage to the CIA from this incident that appears to be both a diplomatic embarrassment and an intelligence setback for the United States. Then finally, we'll address the Senate's rejection of Richard Cordray, who the White House nominated as the first head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate at Public Citizen, joins us to discuss the Republicans' apparent allegiance to Wall Street over Main Street and their efforts to kill a new agency created to combat unfair, deceptive, and abusive lending practices that brought about the 2008 financial crisis that continues to depress the real economy today, while bailed-out, bonus-bloated banking gamblers in the Wall Street casino laugh all the way to the bank. Joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Happy to join you.
And clearly we have a fairly dire situation in Europe, at least recently. The new Italian Prime Minister said that if an agreement is not made by Friday, December 9th, the markets will effectively crash the euro. Do you feel that at this point where you've got Chancellor Merkel arriving in Brussels for the European summit saying that the credibility of the euro must be restored, and then prior to that you had Sarkozy speaking in very apocalyptic terms about the great crisis facing Europe, do you think that these leaders are going to finally deal with this problem that's taken 18 months, and the longer they dither, the more expensive the bailout becomes?
Well, it is way past due that you've got the key players getting together and talking about the kinds of institutional and financial changes that are necessary to save the euro. And even more importantly, it's way past due that you finally got Merkel in particular, but also Sarkozy and others, the new technical prime minister of Italy, Mr. Monti, talking in very serious terms, because up till now they have been following the public. They have been lagging behind public opinion that is growing weary, that is skeptical of more European integration. And finally they're saying, listen, this is a make or break moment. This is not just the euro that's on the line. It could be the European project that's on the line. And so finally I think you're seeing the kind of leadership that's necessary. And part of the reason you're getting these rather apocalyptic statements is to try to shock publics and their counterparts into action. I don't think that the lights will go out if we don't have an agreement by December 9, but certainly the markets will punish the economies of the Eurozone more if there isn't a resolution.
So would this apocalyptic talk, with Sarkozy saying recently in Marseille that never has the risk of the disintegration of Europe been greater, the idea that they're preparing their publics, it seems that one of the criticisms of Angela Merkel and her inability, apparently since they're the biggest player in the Eurozone, to come to grips with this crisis has been her own domestic considerations, where the German people simply aren't prepared to accept the idea that a huge bailout is necessary, and they've tended to blame a lot of it on the lazy Greeks and Italians and not the German banks who have obviously made bad loans.
That's exactly right. And Merkel, for whatever reason, made a calculation a couple of years ago that she was going to play it safe and that she was going to mind the coalition that she's in, that she was going to close the nuclear reactors after the Fukushima accident, that she was going to vote no to the Libya intervention in the UN Security Council, all for the sake of kind of catering to, or I would go so far as to say pandering to, certain sentiments within the domestic electorate. And I think what's happened now is she's woken up to the fact that the euro might disappear and that the European project is on the line. And finally, she has realized that it's time to step up to the plate and to turn the gas on high. And the big question is it too little too late, or can she reverse this tide of public opinion that is getting more nationalistic, less pro-European, and get publics to back a move toward what is unquestionably a tighter union, a not a federation in the American sense, but institutions that would give Europe the kind of fiscal responsibility that Brussels should have had when the euro was introduced over 10 years ago.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. And I take it that if you were in the current Obama White House, there'd be a lot of nail-chewing going on. The president recently hosted a European summit where he clearly pressed the Europeans to deal with this situation. And it would seem in a paradoxical sense that Obama's re-election fate in 2012 could well be in the hands of Angela Merkel if they don't get it together, and if Greece leaves the euro in an untidy way and the markets beat the euro to death, then you'll have a global recession, and that will extend here to the United States. So what do you think the president has been saying to the European leaders?
Well, I think there's been a lot of communication behind the scenes because Obama and company have not wanted to appear to be lecturing the Europeans. That could do more harm than good. But behind closed doors and on the phone, I think Obama and Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, and others have been saying, you know, please do what is necessary at the scale that is necessary to calm the markets and to prevent a contagion going from Greece to Italy, to Spain, and then across the Atlantic. And that contagion is a real possibility. I mean, but we Americans have a lot of money invested in European banks. If those banks go wobbly, then our banks go wobbly. And then there's the other issue that, Ian, even under the best of circumstances, we're looking at low rates of growth on the other side of the Atlantic. And that's because what's being discussed now between the key leaders involves a lot of austerity and fiscal constraint, going down to rather low levels of debt. And that means that you're not going to get the growth in Europe that the United States would like to see to help stimulate growth across the global economy. And so I think Obama, to some extent, sees the writing on the wall, and that is that he's going to be heading into re-election at a time when the Western economies as a whole are sluggish. And I think that's why just this week he has begun to take a rather populist tone and try to appeal to the vast swath of America's middle class that has seen its houses foreclosed upon and its wages decline in real terms over the last decade.
So, Charles Kupchan, when the Secretary of Treasury, as he did recently, said that the Europeans have to step up, he also talked about, and he has talked about this for some time, the need for a firewall, a kind of financial firewall to stop the markets from pounding the euro. And obviously, you know, some of the debt's becoming unsustainable now in Italy. And for all intents and purposes, Greece has already dropped off the cliff. Mm-hmm. One statistic that I find that really puts it in perspective, and in fact in an alarming way, is that a couple of economists who are following this European crisis have said that in 2008, and obviously the concern here is that there'll be another Lehman Brothers event in Europe. So if you go back to the 2008, the Lehman Brothers event, the Fed, which the Europeans don't have, put up something like $29 trillion to stabilize the markets back and to stop that crisis from creating a global depression. Conversely, the Europeans so far, the ECB, has only put up €500 billion. So it just seems to me that they're not even anywhere near facing the reality of what this challenge is.
Well, you've sort of got a double whammy. One aspect of it is what you're talking about, and that's the economies of scale and the fact that the Europeans haven't had the willingness to put on the line the kinds of guarantees and loans that are necessary to calm the markets. And that's why the markets keep coming after them. And that's why the bill for acting keeps going up. The longer you wait, the more expensive the tab. And then the other problem is that, you know, as you put it, they don't have a Fed. They don't have a set of institutions in Europe that can moderate this crisis. They do have the European Central Bank, but that doesn't have the kind of authority that we have in the United States vested in the Federal Reserve or the Treasury. But then you have each of the separate national institutions. And a lot of people worried when the euro was introduced, started circulating in 2002, that this is dangerous, that you're heading in to a single currency without the appropriate kinds of institutional oversight, and the Europeans knew it. But the politics weren't there, so they went ahead anyway and prayed that it would work, and the prayers didn't come to fruition, and now they're paying the bill. And that's exactly what Merkel and Sarkozy are discussing now. That is, can we, in hindsight, put the institutions in place to make the euro function successfully? And right now, the jury is still out.
And Charles Kupchan, Angela Merkel has made it clear that she wants the treaty to be changed, and others have suggested that won't be that easy. We subject, as the Swedish Prime Minister said, changing the treaty would take time and trigger the need for a referendum. Here we're talking about if they don't come to deal with this by tomorrow, there's likely to be even a crash of the euro and a global economic crisis. So how do you bring about these changes that this Franco-German plan apparently is based upon a number of provisions, which are to impose penalties for nations that run excessive budget deficits? All 17 Eurozone nations should amend their national legislation to require a balanced budget. The Eurozone countries will have a common corporation and financial transaction taxes, and any future bailouts would not require private investors to absorb part of the cost, as happened with Greece. That's just some of what is on the table. How do you get those kind of an agreements done so quickly when you've got, 27 EU nations here, all of whom will have to sign off on this?
Well, you know, you've got the short term and the long term. In the shorter term, you want to try to increase the capitalization of their stability fund. You want to try to give a sense to investors that banks in Europe are safe. And some of that has already happened, but more needs to be done. And then there's the longer term, and that is the changes to the treaty and the changes to the institutions of Europe to provide the kind of oversight to make sure that this won't happen again. And that's not easy, because depending upon the nature of the changes, you might have to go to public referenda. And public referenda are very complicated. You may recall that in 2005, there was a constitutional treaty. There was an effort by the European Union to sort of do what we did in 1789, to have a sort of constitutional ratification. Well, guess what? It didn't fly, because it was rejected in popular referenda in France and in the Netherlands, and then they sort of scuttled the whole thing, and they don't want to go down that road. So I think what they're going to be looking for is some kind of package deal whereby you don't necessarily in each country have to go to the publics. And the other change that is afoot now is that it may not well be the 27 euro EU members. It may be the 17 euro members. There's a subgroup within the European Union that uses the euro and the rest don't. And I think a country like Britain is not ready to move down this road. So what you may end up with is what's called a multi-speed Europe, an inner core based upon France and Germany that moves more quickly to deeper integration, and Britain and other countries on the periphery hanging back.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown's University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, just in that context, Charles Kupchan, the EU's most recent treaty, which was adopted in Lisbon in 2007, that took 8 years to negotiate. You mentioned the British. The New York Times is carrying a front page story on Thursday suggesting that the British are, are sort of, you know, spectators, helpless spectators on the side. How would you characterize Cameron's role in this?
Well, Cameron, I think, is in an awkward position. He is the head of a party, at least one major section of which is openly Europhobic. And if it were up to them, they would get out of the EU tonight. In fact, not many weeks ago, there was a move among the Tory backbenchers to put forward a referendum to the British public for Britain's future participation in the EU, and that was blocked. But public opinion polls showed at the time that if, in fact, there were a referenda, that a majority of the people who vote would call for withdrawal. And so what that does is it puts Cameron in an awkward position because he cannot be part of Europe's core because he'll alienate his party. But he also doesn't want to completely back away from the EU because it leaves Britain isolated. It leaves Britain marginalized. And I do think that the British face a tough choice looking forward, and that is if Europe does emerge from this crisis stronger, if there are new levels of integration, either Britain gets on the wagon and becomes a leading member of Europe, or it drifts off into Never Never Land, because the idea that it can somehow either be the bridge to the United States or go off on its own is increasingly infeasible in a globalized world. And so I think the British have tough choices ahead when it comes to their relationship to Europe.
Well, the British have also adopted austerity measures that have clearly slowed their economy and ground it to a halt. And, of course, that is also what's happened in Greece. And a lot of what's happening here, I think, is very paradoxical in as much as the only thing that's in the real economic world that allows you to pay off your debts is revenues, and revenues come from economic growth, and austerity stifles growth. So that's a formula that's failed in Greece and failed in England, yet it's still being talked about in the context of what needs to be done here in Europe.
Well, I think that they on both sides of the Atlantic, we are stuck in a situation where we don't have a consensus on how much to cut and how much to stimulate. And as a consequence, we're getting stuck in the middle on both sides of the Atlantic. And I also think a bigger problem that is affecting Europe, and it's affecting us in some ways even more profoundly, is that the stagnation of America's middle class, the impact of globalization on inequality, the degree to which Americans feel that their kids' lives will be of lower quality than their lives, that is making our political institutions, that is making Western democracies weak, ineffective. It's sapping their strength. And I think that one of the reasons that Europe has found it so difficult to deal with this crisis is that it has sluggish, angry, and discontented electorates, which is exactly what we've got here in the United States. So in some ways, this is a problem. This is the problem of deindustrialization and the hollowing out of the middle class is something that is being shared right across the liberal democracies.
Well, in Spain, you've got virtually half of the young Spaniards unemployed.
I mean, 20%+ of Spaniards as a whole are unemployed. And you're right. When you look at the youth, it's somewhere approaching 50%.
So there was some suggestions in order to explain the kind of what's been the Europeans have been accused of, a kind of fecklessness in the face of this 18-month-long crisis, starting with Greece and And as you pointed out, and many others have, the longer you delay the solution, the more expensive the costs become. So it does seem puzzling as to why it has taken so long to reach this point now where both the key players, Merkel and Sarkozy, Germany and France, are talking the kind of language of this is a make or break moment, as Sarkozy said. One explanation that was offered to me by an economist was that there are elements within the highest council of these debates that perhaps explains this, that feel that something has to be done to break the social contracts, to make the Europeans more competitive in this new global economy that you referred to. And that gets to the heart of a real question, doesn't it, about whether you can maintain a standard of living of an American middle class at the same time compete with the Chinese peasants, et cetera.
Yeah, and I do think that we're dealing with a structural problem here, and that our societies and our politics were predicated upon a certain economic model. That economic model has been shattered by globalization and the entry of billions of low-wage workers into the marketplace. And I think that's the main reason that our middle classes and Europe's middle classes and Japan's middle classes are struggling. And that has led to a crisis of governability. It has led to a loss of legitimacy of our domestic institutions. And here in the United States, public opinion of Congress is at historic lows. And that, I think, is the core of the explanation for why Europeans have reacted so slowly. Because this crisis hit at the same time that elites were feeling their electorates run away from them, and at the same time that Europe was being renationalized by the discontent of voters, by a double dislocation, not just European integration, but integration into global markets. And so voters were sort of pulling away. They were saying, what's happening here? I'm losing control over my destiny. And up till now, Merkel and Sarkozy and others were pushed along by the populism, by the renationalization of political life. And I think that's why they didn't act. And now they're staring reality in the face, and they're realizing that they have to reverse course and provide bold leadership. Otherwise, it may soon be game over.
Well, just in closing, Charles Kupchan, it does seem, though, that in many ways, Germany has been the fair-weather friend here. Because at the end of the day, although so much, there's been this north-south divide, this economic problem has to some extent been racialized. I mentioned earlier the notion of the lazy Greeks and Italians who don't pay their taxes. But in reality, it's the German and French banks who were profligate in these loans, particularly the enormous amount of the big housing bubble in Spain, et cetera, largely for Germans' holiday homes were built. But the long and the short of it is, I think it's pretty clear that the Germans, as the center of the euro, have really benefited from it from the beginning, particularly with their export-driven economy. And now it seems that they don't want to pay the piper.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be too hard on the Germans in the sense that they have tightened their belts. They have gone through some of the structural reforms that other European countries need to. And they have been remarkably successful at a brand of high-quality manufacturing that has enabled them to remain competitive despite the entry of Chinese and Malaysian and Indonesian workers into the marketplace. So they've done a good job. They've done an impressive job. But you're also right to point out, number one, that a lot of their income has come from exports to the laggards, the so-called laggards in Europe's periphery, like Greece. So they've benefited from the asymmetries in the Eurozone. And secondly, a lot of the debts that have accumulated in Greece, in Ireland, in Portugal, and other places are held by European banks. There was a credit bubble, an overheating, not unlike there was here in the United States, particularly on real estate, but also on other investments. But I think that it, whether or not you see Germany as having benefited from the game or having contributed to the crisis, they're the most important player. They're the biggest economy. They have the most political influence, and that's why it's so important that Merkel finally seems to have awoken from a deep slumber looked out her window, saw Europe sinking, and said, Jesus, I better get in the game.
Well, Charles Kupchan, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international affairs in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the apparent capture by the Iranians of the very high-tech latest spy platform that the United States has.
Money makes a world go around. These words it makes a world go around. The clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now is John Pike, who's one of the world's leading experts on defense, space, and intelligence policy. He's director of globalsecurity.org, which is focused on innovative approaches to the emerging security challenges of the new millennium. John Pike previously worked for nearly two decades with the Federation of American Scientists, where he directed the Space Policy, Cyber Strategy, Military Analysis, Nuclear Resource and Intelligence Resource projects. He's also been at the forefront of utilizing satellite imagery to monitor worldwide weapons facilities. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pike.
Good to be here.
And clearly the Iranian regime is very happy to display on video what appears to support their claims that they have captured an RQ-170 Sentinel stealth aircraft intact. What do you make of the pictures coming out of Iran?
Well, it's hard to understand. I mean, most of what we think we know about this incident is coming from Iranian government and news sources, which are noted for bragging, making stuff up, and generally distorting the underlying facts. So we certainly cannot accept at face value what they're showing us. The problem that I have in looking at this video is that for a UAV that crashed, it seems to be in remarkably good shape and looks really a lot more like a mock-up that some people over at the university might have made up to put on show. The thing is taped together in a way that is easier to reconcile with it being a dummy than being the real thing. It's very hard to understand how this vehicle could have crashed and yet remain in such good shape.
So in terms of it being in good shape, and if you're suggesting there's a possibility of it being a dummy, would the Iranians have access to the right kind of pictures and stuff? In other words, nobody from the CIA or the Defense Department has come forth with that suggestion, which you'd think, since they're familiar with the aircraft, presumably if the Iranians build a dummy, so far it's fooling people, right?
Well, I don't know that it's fooled anyone. The Iranians would obviously have access to any number of photographs of this UAV that have been posted on the Internet over the last several years, so I don't think they'd have any trouble over a period of a couple of days of coming up with something that they would be able to put on display. Very difficult to understand how this thing could have been in such good shape, having been brought down by some happenstance.
Well, I suppose the fact that there's a curtain underneath it, they've only showed the top surfaces of it, and they've surrounded it with a curtain with anti-American propaganda.
That's right.
What would they be disguising underneath it?
Well, I don't know that they're disguising anything. They just want to get it up to eye level so people will be able to get a good look at it.
Well, in other words, if as they have said, they were able to hack into it and somehow bring this thing down to land on their soil intact, they're not showing the landing gear. That's what I'm suggesting.
Well, we don't see any landing gear there. And, of course, The reality is that if this thing was landing without landing gear, it's going to get banged up pretty good. What we see, in fact, however, is a dent on the front of the wing, and otherwise the skin of the vehicle is pretty much intact and unscratched. It's just very difficult to understand how they could have done that.
So you don't buy the idea that they were able to hack into it then?
I'm deeply skeptical of that.
Well, they say they have the Iranians say they have a special unit.
Well, the Iranians say a lot of things.
Well, I'm not...
You know, I mean, they say a lot of things, most of which turn out to be somewhere between exaggerated and just flat out untrue.
But from your position as a technical expert on these platforms and on space surveillance and reconnaissance, et cetera, is there any way that you could hack into a drone's guidance system? Because presumably, if you could, that would render the entire drone program useless.
Which is why, presumably, it would be extraordinarily difficult to do that, wouldn't it?
Well, so they have countermeasures then, right?
All right, well, the command link is going to be very heavily encrypted. And if you don't have the password of the day, you're not going to be able to get in. And if the Iranians could hack in to our drone command network, that would be hacking into everything all over the place, which manifestly they're not doing.
So the claim that the Iranian Army's electronic warfare unit brought the drone down on the 4th of December as it was flying over the city of Kasmar, which is apparently about 140 miles from the Afghan border, you don't buy that.
I don't buy it. The notion that they would be able to hack into the command data link, I don't buy. The notion that they might have been able to shoot it down with a surface-to-air missile, I don't buy. The notion that it encountered weather problems, had mechanical problems, and Iran is trying to magnify its own military reputation, I have a much easier time believing.
So, but what do you think happened then? I mean...
Well, like I said, I don't know, but it's easy to imagine that it had a weather-related problem or it had a mechanical problem of some sort, and it crashed. And Iran realized that they had the possibility of a propaganda coup on their hands, and the result is the circus that we've seen for the last 3 or 4 days.
So, in other words, they whipped up this mock-up and trucked it out to make the CIA feel bad that they...
Well, they're not going to make the CIA feel bad. They're trying to make the CIA look bad. What they're trying to do is make their military look strong and America's military look weak. The reality, of course, is precisely the opposite of that. But in order to intimidate their neighbors and to reassure their own population, Iran is bragging all the time about how great its military is and all kinds of new and important weapons they've come up with. And then when you get to the underlying facts of the matter, it turns out, of course, to be nothing of the sort.
So is there anything within the skepticism that you've put forth here, John Pike, and some of the other suggestions that somehow or other, and I don't know the somehow or other, they actually have ended up with this latest generation of U.S. spy drones intact? There's nothing that you can think of that could, in other words, between the more logical thing that they only had pieces of something if they shot it down or if it crashed, or this is a mock-up. Is there any other possibility?
It's very difficult to understand how they could have recovered this aircraft with the negligible damage that appears in this video. It's very difficult to understand that. You know, people do win the lottery. You know, strange things do happen. Improbable events do occur. But particularly when we're dealing with a government like Iran that is prone to making crude propaganda, I am always inclined to be skeptical of any of the claims that they're making unless they're backed up by much more convincing evidence than we've seen thus far.
So, John Pike, are there any echoes, though, here of the U-2 incident in the sense that the first cover story out of the CIA was that the plane was flying, looking down over western Afghanistan, where apparently there are no Taliban. I mean, that's basically Northern Alliance country. So the cover story didn't make any sense. I mean, isn't it pretty clear that this plane's been used to look at Iran's nuclear sites?
Well, it would make sense that you'd be using a stealth drone to fly over Iran as opposed to over Afghanistan. America controls Afghan airspace. You really don't need stealth aircraft there. If you were keeping track of Iranian nuclear missile facilities over Iranian airspace, you'd be wanting to use a stealth drone like this one.
And they did use this particular type of drone, I believe, to loiter over the compound where Osama bin Laden was hiding out and give the White House real-time intelligence as that raid took place.
That's been reported.
Right. So how many of these things do they have? Because my understanding is that, you know, if the Iranians' claims are real and they have this thing, it's a big loss. But furthermore, I believe there aren't too many of them.
Well, we don't know how many of them there are. The number would have to be in the dozens, however. And there are undoubtedly more where this came from.
Uh-huh.
This would not be the only classified stealth drone that the intelligence community would be flying. They've spent billions of dollars on similar drones over the last decade, so undoubtedly there are plenty more where this came from.
Well, there's a report in Thursday's New York Times about this drone, this loss of this drone, that suggests that it has an extremely sophisticated radar that the Russians and the Chinese would love to get their hands on. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't.
But would that seem to be plausible?
Well, it's certainly plausible that it would have a radar on board. It would certainly be plausible that the Russians or the Chinese would like to get a hold of it. Whether they're going to be able to do anything with it or about it is a completely different question. Both of these countries have had a very hard time copying Western technology. If they were able to copy it, they wouldn't need to copy it because they could build it on their own.
Well, didn't the Chinese copy the F-22 stealth fighter? At least they trucked out something that looked remarkably similar.
Well, they trucked out something that looked similar to the F-22 stealth fighter, the same way India, along with Russia, trucked out something vaguely similar to the stealth fighter. But the bottom line is that if you're going to build a stealth fighter, you're going to wind up with something that has a family resemblance to the American stealth fighter. The difference, of course, is that we first flew our stealth fighters over 20 years ago, and now it's taken 2 decades for the Chinese to catch up. Generally, the Chinese are running about 2 decades behind the United States. If you look at what we were doing in the 1980s, those are the sorts of things that we're seeing the Chinese do today.
Well, but there's the assumption that on these top secret CIA programs that they employ the latest technology in intelligence gathering and surveillance and satellite imagery and radar, et cetera.
Well, they do, but simply having one, you know, radar antenna isn't necessarily going to do you any good if you don't have the software that's doing the signal processing for it. And having a jet engine that's highly fuel efficient doesn't mean that you can build one on your own. I mean, the Chinese got a copy of a commercial jet engine, Western jet engine, the CFM-56, back in the early 1980s. This engine was derived from the American military jet engine that had been designed in the 1960s to power the B-1 bomber. Well, here the Chinese are a quarter of a century later, and they still are not able to manufacture reliable, fuel-efficient copies of this engine that they've been working on for 25 years that's based on an American design that now is nearly half a century old. So simply having one copy of a piece of Western technology doesn't mean that you can emulate it and manufacture it on your own.
So just in terms of hardware versus software and how valuable the software is in terms of these intelligence platforms, when early in the Bush administration there was the loss of that Orion spy plane, the Navy plane over China, and they got the plane intact, but apparently they did everything they could aboard that plane to destroy the software. Then the subsequent reports came out that the Chinese actually got some value out of it. So can you give us a sense of would the software be on this spy platform the Iranians claim to have?
Well, it would have to have some software on
sure.
it. Once the plane is damaged, that software is going to evaporate.
I see. So is there some kind of erasure, destruct mechanism?
It's a classified program. I'm not conversant with the details of
it. I see.
Frankly, if I was, I certainly wouldn't be telling a radio audience about those details.
No, I understand. I just was trying to assess. I was trying to do our own damage assessment for what it's worth.
Well, it's a classified program. We don't know that much about it. What we do know about it is the shape of the air vehicle, and that's most of what makes it stealthy.
I see. Well, it sounds to me, though, John Park, just in closing, that you're not losing too much sleep over this.
Well, I'm losing a lot of sleep fielding reporters' questions over the last several days, but I'm not losing a lot of sleep about Iran, China, or Russia getting this drone.
I see. Well, I thank you for joining us here today.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with John Pike, who is one of the world's leading experts on defense, space, and intelligence policy. He's director of globalsecurity.org, which is focused on innovative approaches to the emerging security challenges of the new millennium. John Pike previously worked for nearly two decades with the Federation of American Scientists, where he directed the space policy, cyber strategy, military analysis, nuclear resource, and intelligence resource projects. He's also been at the forefront of utilizing satellite imagery to monitor worldwide weapons facilities. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the Senate has blocked the confirmation of the new head of the Consumer Protection Bureau, which, of course, makes Wall Street very happy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you for having me.
And the Senate Republicans blocked an effort to put somebody in charge of the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was created by Elizabeth Warren. The Senate voted 53-45 on a procedural motion. So Richard Cordray is out there dangling. The White House, in a sort of veiled threat, said they might nominate him as a recess appointment. What do you think will happen, Bartlett?
Well, it's a good question. We hope that the president does, in fact, use their constitutional authority and make a recess appointment of Richard Cordray. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which will be, I think, in 100 years, the shorthand accomplishment of this president, is intended to protect consumers against abusive bankers. It's unfortunate that we have to have a police agency to prevent abusive bankers from abusing consumers, but it's obvious that we do. We need a director because the statute, as approved by Congress, prevents a directorless agency from protecting non-bank victims. In other words, the payday lender victims, some of the worst victims of financial abuse without a director. So we encourage, now that the Republicans have done what we expected them to do and to block this, we hope that the president will use his recess authority and put in a director.
So when you say, Bartlett Naylor, that this history will prove this to be the signature achievement of the Obama administration, the formation of the Financial Protection Bureau, that might explain why the Republicans are so determined to destroy it.
Well, it's unfortunate that's the case. And what that plays out is the incredible grip that Wall Street has over Washington, and their grip is reflected in this vote today. I mean, I think this will be part of that history book. The list that comes out of those who voted for and against will be remembered, I think, for a long time, because the power of Wall Street is the power to make campaign contributions, and unfortunately, we have a cash and carry Congress, especially when voters are unaware and are buried in the complexities. And I think that what took place today was an attempt to dramatize, to make the theater very real of whose side the various senators are on. This is Wall Street versus Main Street. This is the real economy versus the bonus-bloated banking gamblers, the 99% versus the 1%. And I think that's what happened today, and it needs to be reinterpreted as you are doing for the American voter as they hold their senators accountable.
So let's then, Bartlett Naylor, again, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch. He was formerly the chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. The Senate voted 53-45. They need the 60 votes. Everything apparently nowadays requires 60 votes to pass in the U.S. Senate. 53, that's not all of the Republicans, not all of the Democrats, right? So there must...
It's the Democrats. It's actually missing John Kerry, who was absent. It's missing one Republican who voted yes, Senator Brown of Massachusetts. And interestingly enough, a Republican, Senator Snow, who voted present.
I see.
She explained later that her husband works for a private college, a for-profit college, I should say, and student lending is part of the issue, and the abuses of student lending is one of the areas that the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will go after. A curious vote. Presumably, education issues affect. She'd be voting on in a number of areas, but we'll take it. We'll take that as a reason. But you make the basic point: is on a procedural motion, this nominee was prevented from advancing.
And everybody says that he's a sterling fellow. He's all of the attorney generals, or just about all of them across the country, including a lot of Republicans. I believe the Republican attorney general from the state of Utah went to the White House to support Richard Cordray. There was some fairly intense lobbying going on, but to no avail.
Well, this is not really about. What's important is this was not about the credentials of the nominee. Blatantly, 44 senators signed a letter saying, unless you eviscerate the powers of this agency, we won't let anyone, Buddha, Jesus Christ, George Washington, be head of this agency unless you dismantle, defang, delay this agency. And why is that? Well, the real reason is that Wall Street paymasters demanded. Unfortunately, the abusive, unfair, and deceptive practices of Wall Street, and that's the legal mandate that the CFPB is intended to contest, has become the value proposition of the financial industry. Those are not my words. Those are the words of Barney Frank, the former chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. And that profit source is what is at play, and if the CFPB successfully combats that, that will reduce or help to reduce the financial sector from 20% of the GDP back to 10%, where it is now to where it was after World War II.
Well, obviously, the Republicans are basically saying that we're not going to allow a director in place unless you weaken this agency. But you say that's the lobbying from Wall Street. But it would seem to me that also, if the real motive of killing the directorship of this agency making it useless in terms of its ability to oversee payday lenders and these so-called non-regulated, non-bank institutions that are not regulated unless there's somebody in charge of this agency. Wouldn't it be these bottom feeders on Capitol Hill that represent the payday lenders, the ones that exploit servicemen, and they charge up to 300% interest that would make the mafia embarrassed?
That's the collateral damage. It's not the payday lenders who are lobbying. It is the demand letter that was written last spring by the 44 senators, and they will be part of the scandal when this great history is written. It will be like the Keating Five of 25 years ago. They will have a lot of questions to answer, but they said that unless you dismantle this agency, we will hold this director hostage. Now, the collateral damage, the innocent victim of this hostage situation is that the payday lender victim and that mafia figure, the loan shark, will continue to get to abuse that payday lender victim. That's not really what this is. That's not really the main dynamic, but that's the victim that you're seeing now.
Well,
this very cynical calculus. I'm from Idaho, and this has been a very rude awakening for me over the last number of years to see how the sausage is made. But they are willing to throw actual people under the bus, these payday lender victims, because of this larger contest over eliminating or dismantling the actual Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
But that's not to say about the Naylor that the payday lenders don't have a lot of traction on Capitol Hill, and these for-profit colleges. I understand that something like $60 billion a year goes to these crooks who get these veterans and other people aspiring to get an education. They get the Congress to give them cheap federal dollars, which then they charge back to these students at an enormous high interest rates and strap them with lifetime debt and then hand them a useless diploma at the end of the day. I mean, it seems to be totally cruel what's going on, not to mention payday lenders who obviously prey on poor people and charge, 300% interest. I mean, isn't that a scandal in itself?
That's right. I agree that it's the tragedy of what's happening. I would say that tragedy is a sideshow of who's truly pulling the strings. In other words, I don't think Susan Collins from Maine or the other 43 senators are doing the bidding precisely of these bottom feeders.
Yeah, but you said that Olympia Snow recused herself because her husband works for a bottom feeder.
Well, yes. Well, I have to deal with that office on a daily basis, so it is difficult.
I don't want to put you in a difficult position.
Yeah, as you are.
Okay. Well. But the long and the short of it is that the real beneficiaries of stalling this appointment and making this agency not function, it benefits the non-state the non-bank. Sector. That's the payday lenders, the private student loan providers, and other mortgage originators. But these are the same people, of course, that had a lot to do with the original financial crisis.
And some bankers understand that. Some community bankers realize that, it's not that banking is bad, it's that abusive banking is bad. Honest bankers serve a very important role, and it's the abusive banker that has made it bad for the rest of the financial system. And unfortunately, there are divisions, there are antagonisms. It's difficult for an Occupy Wall Street person to walk in and enjoy a cordial conversation with a banker. But in fact, there are alliances that should be formed. I mean, this is about abuse and not class, if you will.
So, but it's an interesting irony that the fat cats on Wall Street in the big casino are pulling the strings that benefit the bottom feeders.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I don't know that they intend that.
I see. But so, what is their intention then? The big Wall Street people in the big casino.
Well, I think that just as the left isn't always perfectly well organized and allows democracy to interfere with efficiency sometimes, I think that the big bankers who have enjoyed a lot of the extraction of huge fees, credit card, debit card, et cetera, are very wary of a tough Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And it is an accident that the hostage taking will actually liberate or continue to enable this other sector, the very worst of the sectors, the mafia, if you will. I think if they were all to get into a room and say, can we please let this go through? Let's do it. But I think that if you ask Richard Shelby, the ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, he is praying that that the president makes a recess appointment and gets this battle off his back, because this is not a happy fight for him. But now that he's in it, it's difficult for him to reverse course and say, okay, I've been wrong for the last 5 months.
Well, but obviously this would be a good grist for the election mill for the Obama White House, but I don't see them.
I agree with that. And that's the cynicism. I mean, Public Citizen is a nonpartisan organization. Our goal is not to get the president reelected. Our goal is to try to help the victims of financial abuse. And to the extent that this is a good, rallying effort to show good versus evil and so forth, that's simply not a game that we play. Our goal is to get the victims of, as you call it, the mafia bank, to be reformed. So we think the president should use whatever power he has, whatever legal power he has, to confirm or to get through this appointee, to make the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau fully enabled.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes into the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. Bye.